The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free news feeds.
Welcome to Author Spotlight. My guest is Jonathan Rose, author of The Well-Tempered City. Mr. Rose is an urban planner and developer, and in his new book, he takes readers on a tour of the evolution of cities from the historic cities of yesteryear right up to the cities of today and what he envisions the cities of tomorrow will be. Jonathan Rose, welcome to Author Spotlight.
Mike, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. You make a point in the book that in 1952, only 30% of the world's people lived in cities. Now more than half of them do. And by the end of this century, that number is going to grow to 80% of the world's population are going to be living in urban settings. What is the gravitational pull of cities?
The pull of cities is opportunity. Now, first of all, let's understand where all this growth is coming from. The majority is coming from the developing world. The Western world is actually fairly urbanized. The United States reached a point of 50% of people living in cities around 1900 as people moved from the farms to the factory jobs. And today, if you think of the definition of cities as really metropolitan regions, over 80% of America's population lives in cities and metropolitan regions. We're going to continue to see growth of cities in the United States, in Europe, Japan, and Australia, but at a more moderate pace than the rest of the world. What's driving in this urbanization of the developed world is that's where all the jobs are, that's where the great education is, that's where young people want to be, that's where the action is. And interestingly, we're seeing that older people who used to retire to what we call the sand states, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, North Carolina, where they would retire for leisure, are now retiring to cities for culture and to be with their grandchildren. So that's what's going on in the developed world. In the undeveloped world, the grinding life on the farm, the world is just no longer sustainable. It is not working. And the deep poverty that we see in rural areas is something that people, if they can, they want to escape. So they move to the city to try and find opportunity to make a little more earnings and to educate their children. We see particularly women do substantially better once they move to cities and if they live in a low-income rural area in the developing world. So we have these two different trends going on, all leading to increased urbanization.
So no doubt this is posing some challenges for cities. There's this crush of population moving in, more so in certain cities than others. But what are some of the challenges that are being faced by modern cities, considering that they're seeing their populations in many instances increasing?
The challenges are twofold. The first one is infrastructure, and the second one is affordable housing. There are many other challenges too, but let's take those to start with. So in the developing world, what we're seeing is that this rapid growth is completely unplanned. It's leading to slum sprawl. We're seeing at the edges of all of many of the developing world cities, vast estates of illegal occupancy where people just settle wherever they can, build little shacks, doesn't have proper water and sewer. They steal their electricity if they can from nearby lines. And slowly over time, those communities tend to get formalized and roads get built and some infrastructure gets added. But it's all unbudgeted, unplanned, and very environmentally destructive, and it provides very unsafe and unhealthy living places for people. In the developing world, in the developed world, what we're seeing is that as cities are growing, they may have sufficient water and sewer capacity because many of the Western world cities were actually larger in the 1950s than they are today. But in the 1950s, they also moved much more towards a auto-based infrastructure, transit infrastructure system, and now they need to retrofit with light rail and streetcars and bike lanes, or seeing a whole new transit infrastructure being reinserted back into these cities. And in much of the world, not so much in the United States, we're seeing intercity transit, high-speed rail, which is doing an amazing job of linking cities that might have been off the economic map before high-speed rail came into being, but become on the map once high-speed rail gets connected. And then the issue of affordable housing, that in all these circumstances, we're seeing an increased gap throughout all the world between the incomes that people have and the cost of housing, and this is leading to a tremendous affordability crisis. In the United States, over 20 million American families spend more than 50% of their income on housing. There's more suburban poverty in America than urban, so most of these families are spending a lot of money every month on their cars, on car payments, on the fuel and insurance, etc. And so they really have only 20 or 30% of their income left for the basic necessities, and that's just not viable. It makes the American dream very, very distant. And again, in the developing world also, people can barely afford the shacks that they're living in. And so this transition, to make the transition into urbanization possible, we need much better infrastructure and much better affordable housing. Then there are other things, education, healthcare, new energy sources also, that all need to come with that. But those are the two prime issues I see.
Now, you go back in time to draw lessons from the cities of the past. So what do those cities of the past inform us about with regard to what the cities of the future might look like or should be designed like?
But there are amazing positive and negative lessons from the past. So first I'm going to give you a positive one. One of the great city planners of the past, the guy who was given credit for inventing the street grid, was named Hippodamus. And we actually call street grids today in cities Hippodamian grids. And he designed an ideal town called Miletus in Greece. It was designed to kind of be the great new vision of what a city could be. And in it he invented something called the Agora. And the Agora was the marketplace. It was where all the commerce happened. And it was also the political marketplace. It was the place, and this was where democracy was founded. And it was where the courts and the legislatures and all the buildings of the democracy took place. And so there was a real vision that democracy and capitalism were deeply intertwined, and they'd intertwine them in place. One of the things that he realized is that great cities actually inspired innovation, as they do today, and that he came up with the idea, he was the first guy to come up with the idea of intellectual property, and that it actually, you should be able to get a copyright or some be able to protect your intellectual property. Back then, he had the protection issued by the city-state, and the income from it shared with the city-state. And so that if you, under the theory that if you lived in a great city and it stimulated a lot of ideas and interconnected you with a lot of great other thinkers, that place would be more generative, and that place deserved a share of the income that came from the generation of ideas. Think about San Francisco today. San Francisco is an incredibly generative location, as is Palo Alto. And yet they both suffer enormously from overstressed infrastructure, and they both have a deep affordable housing crisis and don't really have the funds to help fund it. Imagine if the intellectual property that came out of these two cities also was very modestly taxed in some way, and that was then used to help solve the problems of the city. So that's just an interesting idea that I take from the past and look at how it might apply to the future. But there are also negative lessons from the past. And one of the things we see is that as cities rapidly grow, they consume natural resources. That's what's happening all over the world today. And that when the populations get too large and the natural resource consumption is pushed to the very edge of its ability to support a city, and then the climate changes, as the climate is changing today, and the climate has changed throughout history due to natural causes sometimes, and sometimes in the past even due to some man-made causes. But when the climate changes and it results in particularly drought or other environmental stresses, if the population is too large and the consumption of natural resources is too large, the system collapses. is not enough water. We think, for example, that's why Angkor Wat declined, and that's one of the many reasons why the great Mayan cultures declined. And in fact, although it wasn't climate change, but the Roman Empire actually outgrew its food resources, and that's one of the reasons why it declined. When these declines happen, they can go in two ways. And what we've seen is in societies that if the society has too great an extreme of income inequality, too big a difference between the rich and the poor, then when the stresses come, violence appears, and the decline happens very, very quickly, and the whole civil society decays. What we see is income inequality is accompanied by a lack of trust. And the trust is really a key ingredient to healthy cities. We live together in such densities by a lot of consensus about how we're going to share space, how we're going to share resources, how we're going to all function together. And all that is dependent upon a sense of common culture and common trust. And so we have seen that when societies are under high stress, if the trust is not strong, then the society fails. And that is a significant warning for what many cities will face in the 21st century.
So let's move to the opposite end of the spectrum. Let's move to the future now. What current city do you think is most emblematic of a future city, of what urban life can be or what it will evolve to be?
The one city that I think is most emblematic is Singapore. But what's also interesting is that there are many cities have aspects that represent, I think, the best of what the future could be. So, for example, Finland has an amazing education system, and it's a system in which it does not matter where one lives, whether one lives in the urban neighborhood or rural, the wealthiest part of the city, the poorest part of the city, the quality of the schooling is exactly the same. Think of Florence and its incredible food and that comes from the whole Tuscan region. Hong Kong has a fantastic subway system. Curitiba not only has an amazing not only bus rapid transit system, but had a very innovative system for how to bring education and cultural and health resources to its poor neighborhoods. I could go on and on about many different cities, but I'm going to go back to Singapore. And what I love about Singapore is the effectiveness of its long-range strategic planning and how it uses a strategic goals to, in an integrated way, solve many of its problems. So, for example, Singapore currently gets most of its water through a big pipe from Malaysia. Singapore is an island, and it doesn't have enough water for its own resources, and it actually wants to grow its population by about another 25%. And so they set out a plan and said, by 2080, we're going to be water independent, and to do that, we're going to have water conservation, we're going to recycle water, which cities are beginning to do, actually cleaning their wastewater and turning it back into drinking water. But they said, we also need more reservoirs and to capture more rainwater. And to do that, they mapped their natural areas, and they said, we need to grow the natural areas to have these reservoirs, which is good for the island and more nature. So if we're going to grow these natural areas, what can we shrink? They realize we actually have to shrink the physical platform of the city, but we want to grow our population by 1.5 million. So how do we do that? We're going to have to grow denser and taller. Well, one of the interesting things when you grow denser and taller is it allows for there to be more mass transit and walkability. They noted that 12% of this island's land area was taken up by roads. And they set the goal, could we get this down to 8%? And they felt by the higher density, so that they could have more land available for nature and water conservation. And they felt they could achieve that by higher density and more mass transit. So it's a beautiful planning process, I felt, that took long-range goals and integrated many elements of the society to create a healthier and better city while focused on what they on their own water independence.
There is a lot of tumult in cities these days, Jonathan, getting back to the present here. And even some of the most well-developed cities, and some would argue the most civilized cities in the world, we're seeing a lot of social unrest. And I think you've addressed this to some extent already, but summarize for us your thoughts as to why we're seeing so much unrest in so many major cities.
The unrest, to me, clearly is correlated with what people feel is an unequal landscape of opportunity. We now know from a lot of social science research that opportunity is deeply correlated with one's zip code. Where one grows up, we now know that if you map where, for example, in America, where children grow up by zip code, you can statistically predict whether their incomes will be higher or lower than their parents. Now they will do. And we've even seen that when children move at different ages from one zip code to another, if they move at a very young age, they adopt all the positive characteristics or negative characteristics of that zip code, and the later they move, the less they adopt of those characteristics. In 2011 in London, there were riots in the summer, quite unexpected. And what was interesting is that the riots didn't take place in the poorest parts of London. They actually took place on the fault lines between the lower middle class neighborhoods, which were primarily immigrant, and the middle class neighborhoods. Because in London, the cultural, social, structural system, so many people felt like they'd worked hard. These were now primarily second generation immigrants, and they just couldn't, no matter what they did, they could not move any bit forward from lower middle class to middle class. So the answer is that all of our cities have to dedicate themselves to equalizing the landscape of opportunity, to saying that any child who grows up anywhere in the city will have an equal opportunity to move ahead in their lives. They're all not going to move ahead equally. Some will do better and some will do worse and some will stay the same. I don't think people are so concerned about the outcomes as they are concerned about having a chance for a better outcome.
Now, you write in your book about a next great shift in urban planning. Just describe what the shift is as you see it and what's driving it.
We've always known that great plans are have a strong community-based element to them. They need leadership from the top, but they also need an enormous amount of leadership and participation from as many people who can participate in a community plan as possible. What's happening in planning is, but we've always planned in what I call a static way. We've designed a vision for the future, we've done a lot of work, we've kind of defined what the plan is, then we fix it, and that's the plan for 20 years. We're going to move from this static planning system to a dynamic planning system. Just the way that we now all through Waze or Google or whatever receive dynamic traffic driving information that can tell us take this path or that path because there's been an accident, we can now do this with our city planning. I think the goal is for communities to really establish what are known as community health or community well-being indicators to define what do they want to be as a community. How good and equal do they want their education systems to be? How pure do they want their water and their, the rest of their environment to be? How affordable do they want their housing to be? How many parks and how much open space do they want to have? Once they, you know, how easy do they want it to be to connect to work and to connect to healthy food? Once communities define these community health indicators, then we can, through scenario planning, actually begin to project every time a new building is built, a new redevelopment is happening, a new road is planned, a mass transit system is planned, it can be run through a system that actually projects, does this strategy get you closer or farther away from your long-term goals that have been established? Even more, using the Internet of Things and all the data, the huge amount of data that we now generate, we can take all this information and feed it back and in real time understand, are our education outcomes getting better? Is our housing becoming more or less affordable? Are our health care outcomes becoming better or worse? And we can continually adjust our plans based on real feedback from real systems, which means that tools like zoning and regulations and incentives and investments that cities make sometimes make by guesswork in the past can be made informed by real data, and we can continually be tuning the city dynamically towards the goals that it seeks. And this begins to work like nature. Nature evolves with feedback systems, and I think could lead to some really unexpected and extraordinary improvements in cities.
Let's get to your book's title. It's called The Well-Tempered City. What is a well-tempered city?
The idea came from the musical idea called temperament. About 2,500 years ago, Pythagoras came up with the idea that he observed that the ratio between the notes in a musical scale were exactly the same as the ratio between the planets. And he said, aha, I've found this formula that permeates the universe and it's the order of things. He was actually right. There is this proportion does permeate a lot of the known universe, and it's not the only order of things, but it's one of the orders of things. And so for the next 2,000 years, all in Western music, all scales were tuned in this Pythagorean perfection. The problem was that each scale was slightly out of tune with every other scale. And so when you tried to play different keys or scales together, it was excruciatingly imperfect. About 500 years ago, a scholar in China figured out a solution to this, which was to slightly tune the notes, not so perfectly, but good enough so they sounded well, but they could also to tune them in between the two extremes, and they actually sound quite wonderful together. This came to Europe, and at the same time, and I call that an operating system, this musical tuning system, and at the same time a new technology was invented called the clavier, which is a forerunner of the piano, and all of a sudden, composers and musicians had a new operating system, a new technology, and the first to really make something of it was Johann Sebastian Bach, the great composer, and to explain to people how to use this new system, he composed an amazing work called The Well-Tempered Clavier, and in it, he chose to use every single note and every single scale or key on the clavier and have them all work together. But he didn't just do it as a textbook. Bach was a deeply spiritual man, and he composed for the church. And in this work, he has his vision as to what was the true harmony of the universe, the kind of vast expanse of relationship and perfection that he saw that he could express on earth in music. And my sense is that number one, the integrated systems that I just described to you that we all of a sudden have the data to be able to work with is this new form of temperament that we can bring to our systems. The temperament is also, as I said, equalize the notes. And we also need to equalize, as I said, the opportunity for people. And if we can both, and the last thing is that Bach, in effect, was trying to find harmony between humans and nature. And so if we can use these new modern systems to equalize the landscape of opportunity for all and to create better harmony between humans and nature, to me, that is the well-tempered city.
Your book presents five characteristics that cities can develop to meet the challenges that you've outlined earlier and even prosper by these. And those five characteristics are coherence, circularity, resilience, community, and compassion. So I want you to elaborate briefly on each of those. Let's take them one by one, starting with coherence.
Great. So coherence I've already talked a little about. It's really the idea of bringing multiple elements together, and it's how we need to plan in the future. The 20th century was a time of, from a government point of view, great siloization. We had all these departments and cities that functioned very independently. We are now seeing that they're very codependent. So, for example, there's a whole movement seeing the interrelationship between health and housing. A lot of the asthma epidemics that we're experiencing are not just from a medical condition. They're from mold in low-income apartments, or they're from the exhaust of buses whose engines aren't well-tuned. The bottom line is that when we break down the silos and see everything as much larger integrated systems, we're able to plan much better and get better outcomes. That's the basic concept of finding coherence amongst these. One of the stresses that's going to come in the 21st century is that when we have 10 billion people on Earth, which is what's projected by 2050, and 80% of them living in cities. Remember, I said that people move to cities to find opportunity. And one of the reasons that so many people move is because they do find opportunity. They do become more prosperous. We're seeing a dramatic rise in middle-class life in cities around the world. And as people become wealthier, they buy more. So the world is running into a huge resource gap in which there's just not enough raw material to feed all the consumption that's coming. At the same time, with the climate changing, through much of the world, it's not only getting hotter, but it's also getting drier, and so we're seeing water gaps. The idea of, this is actually we're running into a brick wall of mismatch between natural resources and human consumption and population. And as I mentioned in the past, whenever we hit such a wall, particularly if there's income inequality, there's been a collapse of civilization. So the answer is we need to move from having linear systems to circular systems. A typical city takes in a bunch of stuff every day. We call that the metabolism of the city, a bunch of material, energy, water, food. And 98% of that leaves the city within 6 months as waste. Imagine if instead of such a linear system, we had circular systems where resources came in and were recycled. I'll give you an example. Windhoek is the capital of Namibia. It's a desert city in southern Africa. And it was rapidly growing in the 1980s, and it realized it simply did not have enough water for its people or its future people. And so using some amazing engineers, they designed the first system in the world that would take their wastewater, their sewer water, completely purify it, and feed it back and turn it into drinking water. And over the last 40 years, that system has run flawlessly. There's never been an accident, and it has allowed the city to grow dramatically. We're now beginning to use systems like that in America's Southwest because there's with the climate drying up, there's been a tremendous risk of those cities running out of water. There's a sewage treatment plant in Virginia which took this one step further, and as it purifies the water, it's been saving what it extracts. So two of the components of wastewater are phosphorus and nitrogen, which are key components of urine. They're taking these out for $100 a ton and selling them to fertilizer manufacturers for $400 a ton. So all of a sudden, the sewage treatment plant has not only become a circular system, but it's become an income-generating factory. Many sewage treatment plants are now capturing the methane that is generated by them and turning it into electricity, not only to fuel the plant entirely, but to fuel buildings in the neighborhood. There's a new process that's emerging where the very process of waste treatment itself, the digestion of waste, directly, not through burning methane, but directly can create electricity. So as we can begin to tighten, basically, the relationship between our inputs and our outputs in these linear systems, I'll give you another example of another one. Anything that uses energy creates waste heat. And that just goes into the air right now. But we can actually capture that waste heat through heat pumps and other loops and such, and reuse it. It can actually be used for cooling. It can be used for heat in other parts of the city. We're creating microgrids and micro districts now that loop the energy inputs and outputs and waste heat inputs and outputs of neighborhoods like that. So circular systems are amazing infrastructure ways of thinking that will lead to enormous resilience. We're seeing not only natural systems resilience, but also human resilience. Again, cities in the 21st century will have tremendous stresses from climate change and population growth and many other factors. Resilience is the capacity to, and we're also, the cities will have much greater volatility. We've already seen a lot of financial volatility in the last decade. We know there'll be climate volatility. We know that there's population volatility. Some cities are rising. Many cities are shrinking at the same time, too. Resilience is the ability to go with the volatility and to, when hit by peaks of volatility, to bounce back. On the physical side, what we're seeing is that the best responder to volatility is nature, and that bringing nature back into cities really adds to its resilience. For example, neighborhoods that have a lot of street trees are 6 degrees cooler during the summer than ones that aren't. And therefore, they're going to be do better when climate change heat increases. By the way, at the same time, those neighborhoods also have higher real estate value, and so they generate, they're not any more valuable for the homeowner, but they generate more real estate taxes for the community. So planting street trees, it turns out, is a fantastic win-win approach to increasing resilience. Even more, when you plant street trees, they absorb stormwater and take pressure off storm systems if there are heavy rains. There are many ways that we can weave nature back into the cities and use it to increase the physical resilience of the city. But there's also the issue of human resilience. And I don't know about you, but I'm finding the pace of life is picking up, continues to speed up. The demands upon our time are increasing ever, and people are feeling really highly stressed. We have now seen this stress is particularly high in very low-income communities, and in fact, the passing on of stress and trauma may be one of the causes of multigenerational poverty. I described the shared mindset in neighborhoods as just a way of a physical ecology as the cognitive ecology. And we can actually map that and see that in some neighborhoods, it too can be higher or lower, better, healthier, or less healthy, and that has enormous effects on well-being. In 1997, there was an enormous heat wave in Chicago, and a sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg mapped where the deaths took place from the heat wave. And the lowest death rates were in the wealthy white neighborhoods. The highest death rates were in the poor black neighborhoods. But there were two poor black neighborhoods that actually did better than the wealthy white neighborhoods. And that's because these neighborhoods had fantastic social networks, mostly church-based, in which people every day visited the elderly, brought food to them, checked in to see how they were doing, they watched out for the kids, etc. And that network, which was designed in a time when there wasn't a heat wave, provided enormous resilience during the time of heat wave. So one of the things we're learning is actually that healthy social networks and something called collective efficacy, the ability of neighbors and communities to voluntarily work together, are tremendous aspects of resilience and lead to the, remember I mentioned earlier, much earlier, that when the stresses come, when there's a lot of income inequality, civilizations collapse. Well, when they have a lot of shared networks and they have a lot of collective efficacy, they actually thrive. As a author named Rebecca Solnit, who wrote a book called Paradise Built in Hell, and she describes how under certain circumstances when there are high stresses in society, how well people come together. So, for example, when 9/11 happened in New York City, people just streamed out in the streets to offer to help each other. Crime disappeared. That spirit also can arise when there's high stress, and that is part of the resilience that will lead to healthy cities. The next characteristic is community, and I pretty much described some of the conditions of it. But we also know there are physical conditions of the best communities, and that is they have affordable housing, they have great transit options, both walkable and mass transit and use of car and others. They have fantastic schools, great healthcare systems, access to healthy food, arts and culture, spiritual access to places of reflection and spirituality, and that these are all connected into a fabric of a neighborhood, and that people have a sense of being able to easily access all of that. And then the last condition that's really necessary for great cities is compassion. Humans are always balancing self-betterment and self-survival, the we-ness, or the me-ness, I don't mean mean, but M-E as in me, myself, and the desire to improve life for oneself and one's family, and we-ness. We are socially related and the relationships that we have with others. When societies become too focused on the me and not enough on the we, the issue of trust, which I've described before, social fabric, of collective efficacy, all that gets undermined, and it actually weakens society. The quality that best brings forth the sense of we-ness is this recognition that we are all in it together, that I am my brother's keeper, that I should do unto others as I would have them do unto me. And the basis of all of our religions affirm this idea, and the expression of it is altruism and compassion. We will never be pure and perfectly compassionate people. We will never live in a perfect and compassionate community, but we can shift the bell curve of human behavior towards compassion. And the more we do, the more resilient and better and happier our cities will be.
Jonathan, you also suggest that modern science indicates to us what the future of urban life might or should be like. Explain, please.
There are many kinds of science that I draw from, but in this case, I particularly draw from the cognitive neurosocial sciences, and we're just learning much more about human nature, and we've learned a whole lot more about what really drives well-being. And we've learned that well-being, people need to have enough prosperity to know they can take care of their families and feel secure, but a lot more wealth actually doesn't make people happier. Some of the things I've already described come from science, that modern social science, that has shown us how important social relations are to us. And they've also shown to us how important our own neurological and cognitive mental health is to our state of well-being and the state of well-being of our communities. And we're beginning to learn more and more what we can do to improve that. So that's one of the really important things we're learning from science. We're also from science learning a lot more about the environment and climate, about toxins, heat waves, droughts, all those things are becoming much more predictable. And we're learning better how we can design solutions to adapt to the stresses of those things that are coming ahead. And I also mentioned information science, how we're seeing that information science is giving us the tools to be much better predictors and to more dynamically fine-tune the evolution of our cities to move them ever towards better well-being for their residents.
The title of the book is The Well-Tempered City. The author and my guest is Jonathan Rose. Jonathan, a lot of really fascinating research in this book, and I think I probably join most of our listeners in hoping that your vision of those future cities come to fruition, because it sounds like a much better situation than many of us are living in these days. Thanks a million for taking the time to run through this with us.
And Mike, thanks so much for your really wonderful questions.